We're, as you can see from the sign, we're starting with the development section. That's starting today, and we'll move into next week with this. Developments. Development is the great no man's land of Sonataform. Whenever you're doing an analysis of a Sonataform movement, the exposition, as you know by now, is fairly clear cut, right? You know how to do it, you write a LaRue chart, you go through it, and so on. The recap is in many ways pretty clear cut because you create LaRue charts, you compare it with the exposition. There are forms for both the exposition and the recap. There is no form for the development. Mm-hmm. The development itself can be almost anything, any order, any shape, any style. And because of that, doing the analysis of the development can be very, very difficult. Can be very, very hard because you don't quite have anything to grab onto. So what I want to do is take you through development and give you some strategies for dealing with them, and also teach you about some features that many of them share in common or that you may encounter during a development. So this is a much more, I guess you could call it sort of open-ended sort of section here, in that in talking about something which is much less cut and dried than what we've been learning. But this is what the development is for, just to put it in the simplest of possible terms. And that is that the modulation to 5 in the exposition, as you know, the exposition begins in the primary key and ends in the secondary key. I'm calling that the modulation to 5, 5 standing as the secondary key. This mandates a return to 1. For the recapitulation. So in effect, the development is a large-scale 5-to-1 motion. That is in a major key. In a minor key, it's a large-scale 3-to-1 motion as a rule. So in other words, it's simply a large-scale chord progression back to the original tonic. That's why it can be omitted. Sonataforms, sometimes there are sonataforms that don't have developments because in point of fact, it's not actually needed. It's not a required part of the form, although almost all sonataforms will have it. It's not absolutely required. Now, the way a development might work, there are all sorts of different ways, but one of the most common things you'll find in a development is the development of material. That's why we call it the development. We'll find a lot of transformation of themes. That's one of the things we can almost always count on finding, but not always. Among those, this is not all of them, but fragmentation of the themes. What that simply means is cutting it up into little pieces. A wonderful classic example of fragmentation would occur in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, in which what we call the big four-note motive, as opposed to the little one. The little four-note motive is this in Beethoven's Fifth. That's the little four-note. The big four-note arrives out of the union of the first and second statements of the little four-note. That, we get this outline. That becomes a motive in its own right throughout the piece. Consider the bridge theme. It's a version of the four-note motive. But what happens is that the four-note motive becomes, among other things, in the development section, he starts going. It becomes 2, and then at one point it becomes 1. So in other words, the theme starts at 4 notes, it is then trimmed to 2 notes, and then it's trimmed to 1. That's what fragmentation is all about. It can also be, for example, Mozart G minor symphony, which is. Well, if he starts going. That's fragmentation as well. It's taking it apart and snipping it up. Deformation simply means exactly what the word is. In other words, the basic shape of the theme is changed. Not so much that we lose track of it, but it is deformed in some way, stretched, this, that, and so on. The use of themes or fragments in imitative contrapuntal textures, a lot of fancy words there, But what it means is that the creation of contrapuntal elements during the development. In 18th century writing, counterpoint, in late 18th century classical writing, counterpoint is generally fairly subtle, it's unobtrusive sort of thing, unobtrusive. But in the development, you're liable to start getting much more complex polyphony, and sometimes you might even get full canons or even fugues during the development. So there may be a lot of counterpoint and a lot of transposition and sequence, a lot of modulation. Developments are hotbeds of chain phrases, sequential patterns, things like that. There's a whole lot of stuff. So again, they do have a tendency to be sort of wild and woolly like this. There's a lot going on. And every single development is a law unto itself. So we're going to pick, I've picked a representative development out of all the 400 gazillion sonata form movements I could have picked. I've picked a sonata form development that's a particularly masterfully handled thing, particularly well. There's a lot of good ones. There's a lot of sort of follow the format developments. But this one, Beethoven 4, Fourth Symphony, is a really good example of a truly masterful, beautifully structured development. Good morning. Now, I want to talk you through it a little bit before we actually go through and listen to it in the chart and so on. One of the things about developments that they tend to do, and that is that they tend to fall into sections. They're like codas in that aspect, is that the first way to deal with a development is to find out where its main sections are. In the case of Beethoven 4, we have four sections. I just want to describe them to you verbally. Section 1, it starts in F major, which is the key of the dominant. Beethoven 4, as I'm sure you probably know, is in B flat major. First movement, that thing, right? It starts out in F major and makes a very large scale modulatory motion to D major. Now that's a modulation by thirds. He was in F major, and he's going to make his way to D major. Okay, that's a very common, by the way, motion, harmonic motion, is modulation by thirds. Although D major is not a near related key to F major by any means, it's a fairly easy way to go in thirds. He does it by stopping on A major. So he first goes up by a third, and then uses that as 5 of D major. But his large scale motion is to D major, with a stop off in A major on the way. So section 2, which is in this mediant key, it's in the key of the mediant of D major. B flat major is the tonic. It begins with what we call a false recapitulation. A false recap is a statement of the primary theme in the wrong key. And so it's a statement of that, and we hear this, that main theme, but in D major. It then moves on to combine that theme with a new theme that we've never heard before. He begins combining the two contrapuntally, and that new theme really takes on a whole life of its own during this passage. So we would have to call that in, you know, in our analysis. Section 3 makes its way to E flat major. So it's made its way from D major, just up a half step, to E flat major. It's a big, broad, and climactic section. Now think about it, though. E flat is much more closely related to B flat major. E flat is the subdominant. So we're on our way back, but this is a big, long section with a lot of modulation in it, but it's still in E flat. Now section 4 is where things really get interesting. Because what he does, the section 4 is the retransition. This is the point in the development at which we know we're going back to the tonic. We've got to get back. Now he gets his way to a rather enigmatic G major. Remember, the tonic is B flat major. He gets his way to G major. Then through a series of enharmonic shifts, he manages to move that down, okay, to G flat major, which starts out as F sharp major, and he bit by bit starts introducing G flats and B flats in place of the F sharps and A sharps. It's kind of a weird passage. You go through it and think, why? like in one measure the note's F sharp, and the next measure it's G flat, and you're sitting there going, what the hell are you doing? You know, it's very confusing at first. But that, G flat major, he adds a seventh to it, it becomes an augmented sixth chord in B flat major. Now you know, the German augmented sixth chord has to resolve to a cadential 6-4, remember from last semester. And that's what it does. Now normally what a composer would do at that point would be to resolve the cadential 6-4 and get us home to B flat. Beethoven does a very Beethoven-y thing. He never resolves the cadential 6-4. He just hangs on it. Okay? And he gets this low F going in the timpani. He never resolves it, but then he goes to B flat anyway. It works mainly because he won't let go of the F in the bass. And after a while, our ear starts hearing it as a dominant, even though he never states the dominant. It's a fascinating moment. It really is. But it works beautifully, and it's a Beethovenian technique, by the way, that he loves to do, and that is if they don't get it right away, just keep repeating it, and they will. And Beethoven loves to do things where he gets on a single chord, and he hangs on it like a neurotic obsessive for pages. He especially does that with dominants, dominant pedal points. And he'll just hang on it until you're so sick of it that just the fact that he leaves that note is a resolution. Interesting man. So that's the four sections. Now, I chose this also for another reason, and not just that it's a really cool development, but because there are two very good written analyses of it a century apart from each other, and they both agree on the major details, which is really cool. Analysts don't usually agree on much of anything. They're like psychiatrists. Yeah. But the fact is that these two did. Now, one of the analysts was Percy Gerchus. Gerchus is the author of a bunch of different, very, very influential books. He was the big theory teacher of the late 19th century. And he, very much a Marxian. And he wrote a number of books that you can still get and you can still use. I still use them sometimes, like the larger homophonic forms of musical composition. He has a rather inflated writing style. But very fine analysis of this work. And then recently, Peter Brown, who's a modern analyst, it's the fellow that's writing that huge six-volume I've told you about, the six-volume analysis of all of the symphonic literature. Volumes 2 and 5 are out. Volume 2 is all Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven symphonies, analysis of every single one of them. And Volume 5, I think, is out, and it's all Dvorak, Bruckner, Reger, people like that, some of the other ones, Tchaikovsky, it's all in there. So he's, yeah, and complete analyses of every single symphony.
That's really weird.
Isn't that great? Yeah. Yeah, it's rather, and I think I'm obsessive. Man. So six total when he finished, and they're fat.
Only six.
He uses LaRue charts a lot, as you can well imagine. He needs to be, you know, kind of compact. But he does a rather long analysis of this development. So let me show you the analyses. Now, here's how I did this. It's all rather confusing at first. The upper, okay, upper here, right? Okay, this stuff up here. This is the Gerchus analysis. And so he did it, this is Peter Brown, I'm sorry. Peter Brown on the top. It's the four main sections that I just described to you. I described those out of Brown's analysis because I rather liked it. Okay. Primarily, as it says, section one starting at 185, 217, 241, and so on. Now below is Gerchus's. Now Gerchus saw more sections, but if you take a good look at his sections, you realize that his first three sections are really Peter Brown's first section. You'll notice that he says there's a two-measure extension here, no big deal, and then this and that. It's cutting the left side of the screen off, isn't it? Hang on. So that lower one, there are more sections. Ah, here we go. That lower one with the more sections here, but still, it all matches up, you see, very nicely with that. Gerchus and Brown are identical here, and they should be because of the D major. Gurtjes and Brown are identical here again because of the E flat. Now they part company just a tiny bit here. You'll notice that Peter Brown begins the retransition at 281. Gurtjes starts it a little bit earlier at 271. I just went ahead and aligned them vertically. I thought it was a small thing. And so Gurtjes just talks a little more about details, nothing more. Then I added to that below here, I added a reductive analysis, which I thought would be helpful. You know, I like those a lot. And what it does is just shows the harmonic motion. We start at F major, which is an important key center. That's why it's an unfilled note hit. It moves to A major at measure 203, but that's acting as the dominant to something, so I haven't considered it a primary key center, which is why it's not a filled note head. I'm treating it like a dominant, you see, to D major, which occurs at 217. So that's this dominant-tonic relationship is shown there. Then all, harmonically speaking, I treat the entire section, 217 to 240, as just a great big D major, although a lot going on in there. We make it to E flat major in 241. That's another important key. And then here, I'm showing Gesundheit how Beethoven makes this motion to the augmented sixth chord. G major, B natural becomes B flat. B flat becomes A sharp, which is then harmonized with an F sharp. So it becomes sharp 5 for a moment in B flat major. That then inharmonically is respelled as a G flat and a B flat. So it becomes flat 6. That becomes an augmented sixth chord, goes to a cadential 6-4. In Schenkerian analysis, parentheses always mean implied, but not really there. That's what parentheses mean. It's an implied resolution, and then we finally get to 1. So all of it together gives you sort of a nice bird's eye view of the moment, of the movement, of the development. And of course, needless to say, I have an animated listening chart of that, which I think will sound a lot better, won't it, if I turn the stereo on. So it'll be a little too quiet otherwise. Right about there. All right, are you ready? Okay. It'll start with the end of the exposition, the closing theme. Here we go. Derived from PA. Now here we're going to the A major. Here, the C sharp in the bass. It's not root position. And D major now. New theme in the strings. It begins modulating to E flat. Now we're in E flat, and this is more climactic. This is an E natural in the bass. Now, we're actually at the F sharp in the bass, which becomes a G flat right around here. So the bass is a G flat. F. Cadential 6-4, unresolved. Just keep listening to that timpani. It's a low F. He just keeps the timpani on that low F. Keeps it on it, 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 and then, there we go, bang, we're back. Okay. And we're in the recap.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it kind of resolves.
Kind of does, oh yeah.
The theme comes back before it resolves,
yeah.
But it does eventually go to a 5.
Yeah, it eventually, but it kind of but after this, you know. Yeah, after that was kind of a little late there. But, you know, it's very deliberate, you know, on his part to do that. And it works just fine. I think one of the reasons he does it is it pulls us forward so well. He doesn't resolve it to that B flat until we finally get to, but yeah, bum, 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 he does. He finally does. What we never get is a clear F major chord. And that's what we're lacking, because the F major chord is what is resolving the cadential 6-4, because we've, you know, the suspension, the 6-4, never goes to a 5-3. And so that's what's interesting, but the proper analysis of it is as an unresolved dominant. To call this a tonic at 3:05, which is what this the student insisted on doing, is terrible, but I let him get it. I said, okay, fine, you know, it's your funeral. So I think we should listen to it again to give you a chance to go over it again and see what's going on. All right, so here we go. And here we go. Drive from P. Now notice that when the dominant comes, the A major here, it's in first inversion. My analysis doesn't care about that, it just calls it A major. And D major. E flat. Here to bang. G major. We're gonna go, because then I diminished seventh chord. G in the bass. E in the bass. Right, so G in the bass. Our dub. Bum, 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 bum. And then it immediately, very quickly, goes to here. Boom. And again, as you're watching the score, the F sharp just kind of becomes a G flat. Then we get to. And that just hangs. Get to the B flat in the bass, but never an F major chord. He gets away with no dominant at all. It's really quite clever. Now, as you look at this also, this is another key to analyzing a development, which I'll be coming back to later. But those four big sections, each one of them representing a key center. Section number 1, F major, section number 2, D major, number 3, E flat, and then section 4, which is that retransition on our way back. I call those key planes, P-L-A-N-E-S, key planes. That's my term. It's not always a good, but this key planes, these great big broad key centers like that, are the key to analyzing a development, is to break the thing out into its key planes, which will give you a structure. We'll be talking about that more as we go along. But when you have one of these open developments like this, it can be very confusing to figure out how to deal with the thing analytically. And many development analyses turn into these ghastly phrase-by-phrase descriptions. It opens with the main theme for four measures in F major, and then it goes to D major and repeats the main theme again, this time in the flutes. Then, four measures later, I'm reading this, and my eyes glaze over, you know, and I'm thinking, I can't deal with this. It's not, you know, because it just didn't have anything, an analyst didn't have anything really to say about it, and so had to fall into program notes from hell style, you know? So, but we'll talk about this more as we go on. The use of key planes like this can really, really help. Now, let's talk about some aspects of the development now, various aspects that you will not find in every development by any means, but it's just things to begin watching for and looking for. And one of those is how a big area you want to look into is how the composer opens a development. How do they start? How do they get into it? And One of the ways of doing it, we're going to talk about a number of these, a number of techniques, but one of the ways to do this is to start the development with the primary theme. And very, very common practice in the middle of the century, as a matter of fact, it's the de facto standard for starting a development section for sonata form movement in the 50s and 60s, for example, 1750s and 60s, in that, again, the main theme stated in the dominant key. So it almost sounds a little bit like you're starting the expo over again, except you're going into the dominant. It became a bit of a stereotype, obviously, as the sort of thing will, but it was never totally abandoned. You'll find it very, very late sonata forms. You'll find it as late as late 19th century writers still doing it. And you'll even find it in 20th century writers. There's a Ravel sonata form work that does just that. So it was never wholly abandoned. This is our poster boy for early sonata form developments. Out of many that I could have chosen, again, you know, there's so many, I chose Haydn Symphony No. 17 in F major. It's not a well-known Haydn symphony at all. It's a good piece, but it's not well-known. It's from the early 1760s. This is one of the set of symphonies Haydn would have written in his early years as the Weisskapellmeister to the Esterházy family. He was hired as Weisskapellmeister in 1761 and immediately began writing a series of symphonies that he'd already written about a dozen symphonies before that point. And he began really, really developing his chops during this time. It's a really good example, though, of Haydn's and other composers' development practice before the 1780s. It opens with the primary theme in the dominant, and then it very quickly follows it with a statement of it in the tonic, which is interesting. In other words, he reaches the original tonic key within about 5 measures of the development, which seems a little risky, doesn't it?
Was that typical?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. So let's go through it and find out what he did. Now, we have to hear the exposition to understand the development. So, A prime, B. Let's go back. That didn't work. Let's try some. Something went wrong with my video there. Hang on. Let's try it again. There we go, sorry. You notice there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of material. It's typical of early sonata form. Transition. Four. Third measure. Secondary now. The primary theme again. Third, two, now 4 measures. 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, that's the tempo. That's the beat. 3T, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and K. 2 plus 2. And 2 more. And I'm pretty sure it repeats. Yeah, it's a good idea, right? Okay, 2 bars for B. 2 bars for A prime. 1 bar for B prime. And then 2 PA. Repeat it. Then B. 2. 1. 2. And the 2 bars closing. 1 T. Repeats. Now 2T, 1 measure. 2s. 3rd. 4th. Then 4 bars. 1S, based on P. A prime. 2S. B. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 2 bars. Now, Devo, Here we go. Primary theme. B. Then immediately back in the tonic. It works because he starts modulating out of it. B. Two. One. Two. One T. One. Two. Three. And then we're in six here. So. And 3T, which is very complicated, so I simply used a lot of chain phrases. But the dominant, you can hear, bum, 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 three bars. And we're back. I think I'm missing a bar or two in here. I'm not sure, but I'm missing something in there. So, yes.
So is it normal in a LaRue's part to put the chord numerals under the developments, but they're not necessary for the exposition?
No, I just didn't put them for the exposition because this LaRue chart was designed to focus on the Devo. So remember that all charts in analysis, all things used, are always designed for the use of the moment. So one thing I was toying with, I didn't do it for this, was going ahead and putting a reduction underneath Devo so you could see what was going on. So again, for the use of the moment, we will assume that the exposition moved from 1 to 5 somewhere in there. That's a pretty safe assumption, right? But another thing to notice about this, if you take a very close look at it, as the Devo runs along, you'll notice how neatly it lines up with the Expo. And it lines up that way because this is another kind of development. This is a kind of development that follows the structure of an exposition. And there's a whole bunch of those. We'll get to the name later, but I'll tell you now. They are called either expository developments or recapitulatory developments. Either which one is okay because the recapitulation usually follows the structure of the exposition. So we can call it either a recapitulatory development or an expository development. You take your pick. I like expository better. I think it sounds better. Expository development has a much better rhythm and a better sound than recapitulatory development, which is ugly. So I prefer to use the term expository development, being a musician and sensitive to sound. I don't like the sound of recapitulatory. There's something tacky about that word, recapitulatory. It's got a bad rhythm. Recapitulatory, there are too many syllables, okay? But expository development has a nice ring. So I like it better, I recommend it. So just for aesthetics, if nothing else. But this is therefore an expository development, and one that, as you'll notice, follows the form of the exposition without a closing theme, because a close would obviously not be good for a Devo. Devos don't close. So that's what this is. Now, whether it's a sectional development or an expository one, key planes are the way to go with these things. So a key plane analysis is really, really useful, and I really want to recommend it to you very strongly that the first thing you do upon encountering a development is to look for those great big cadences. Not the little ones, but look for the big cadences, look for the big key centers, because that is going to clear the thickets for you real fast. If you start analyzing a development just by starting at the beginning and thwacking your way through, you're going to have a miserable time of it, and you're not going to get much out of it either. You know, you're just going to get lost. So the key plane is a particular well-established key center that is strong, not a transient key center that he bumps his way through, that a composer on their way to something else. Most of the time, the key plane itself marks an important division in the Devo. The same strategy, by the way, is very useful for codas, very much so. So let's do this one again. This is our Haydn Symphony 17 again. But this time we're going to do it as a key plane analysis rather than as a LaRue style analysis. I'm going to do it as key plane. Okay? As I said, this is my poster boy for these kind of devos. Okay? So take a look, if you will, at my key plane. Now, to talk you through it a little bit, to show you how I've done it. One thing you'll notice about these reductive analyses is, again, reductive analyses can be massaged to the needs of the moment. There is no one right way to do it or wrong way. So in other words, whenever you do a reductive analysis of anything, you're doing it for the particular purpose of that moment, what you need it for. So in this particular one, my big purpose is to show you in my key plane analysis that the critical key planes are the key of the dominant and the key of the tonic. The development, after all, is a large-scale motion from 5 to 1. Therefore, look at over here, the only two unfilled note heads. Remember, that's the most important stuff in a reductive analysis. Unfilled are 5 and 1. Devo starts at 55, recap at 113. I have beamed them together. The beam is a kind of a connecting, it's a connector. I have also found in my analysis that there's a very important spot at 80, which is a very important, to my ear, stopping off place on 6, the submediant. We'll be talking more about that next week, but a cadence in the submediant, about 2/3 of the way through the Devo, is a very standard practice. And you'll find it in probably half of the Devos you look at. And we'll be talking about some alternatives. So I have noticed that, and I'm marking it as being important, but not critical. In other words, 5 to 1 is the most critical. Now take a look at a few other areas. Right here, we have a strong arrival on the dominant at 107. It's not the key of the dominant. We're not in C major at this point. We're just on the chord. Reductive analysis does not distinguish between keys and chords, necessarily. They're treated as one and the same, which in large scale sense they are. So in other words, we reach not the key of C major, but 5, and I'm showing that that's a dominant to tonic motion. That's why I stem this. It's an important motion. And the slur shows the relationship. I am showing, going back here a little bit before, that we had arrived at F major as early as measure 89, but not in any kind of solid way. The dotted line here, indicates that all this from 89 through here can be thought of as being a prolongation of the tonic. The dotted line indicates a prolongation of a particular harmony, and it shows that although we were here at this point, the true arrival is not until here. The same thing happened looking back at measure 72. At measure 72, we have an arrival in 6, in D minor. But it's not a really strong arrival. The big arrival is going to be at 80. That's the big one. So what I look at, I'm analyzing everything from 72 through 80 as being a prolongation of that D minor, preparing us for the real strong arrival here. You'll hear that when I play it again. The arrival here is much stronger than the arrival there. Going back from that, this was reached, of course, by its own dominant. D minor was reached by A major. So I mark that here without even bothering to put a measure number. It's a small thing. Mark with a slur. And the fact that it's unstemmed means that it's the least important thing I'm going to put into my chart. Okay? Unstemmed note heads are things worth mentioning, but of no particular importance. And at another level of reduction, if I were to go to a more background level of reduction, those unstemmed notes would go. They'd be out of it. They wouldn't go on. Now going back to the beginning, we start in C major, and you'll notice that I look at 59, that's the arrival of the tonic, that's the main, ya da yum ba da ba da da. I look at it as being a moment, but you notice I don't give it a lot of importance. I give it a stem, to be sure, but I don't give it any other real importance. We move to B flat major here, I mark the fact that we have a harmonic prolongation of that via a neighbor tone motion. These are actually chords, that's a 5-6-5 going back to 1. I then mark the fact that we get to this, which I don't even bother giving a symbol for. It's two. And that we're marked there from a 5-6 into that. So I make my decisions what I'm going to consider the most important. But my analysis, therefore, is saying that there are two big key planes in the Devo, that is C major and D minor, and then the resolution to F major. And those are the big planes, and then there are a few smaller touch-on areas along the way. But this is the way I've kind of made sense of the thing to start with. So let's play it now. I've got a chart here that'll go through it for you, and it'll follow through what I did. Now, you'll notice that sometimes the notes refer to key centers. Sometimes they just refer to chords. It's not a really detailed analysis. For example, I do not mark in here. Where did my thingy go? I did not mark here, which I could have, figures indicating that that right there is a 6-5 chord. I could have, and that's also a 6-5. I could mark more figures indicating what I wanted to, but I wanted to keep it as clean as possible for your viewing and listening pleasure. To F major. Five, six, five to B flat. 6-5 to 1. That's that A major. Now notice that this lasts for quite a while. There's the D minor. Not very important though. And I'm seeing everything in between until, bang, that's important. Then we go. Notice, sequence in fifths. G, C. See, we're on the tonic, but it's not very strong. Everything between 89 and 107 I've reduced out. But until here at 107, there. There. 107, C. So a few things to notice about a chart like this. Obviously, rhythm does not have much to do with my decisions, and it should not. For example, right here, this A that I just put as a tiny, hardly worth noticing feature is what, 8 measures long of that chord. But I don't consider it all that important in the larger scheme of things. So I reduce everything, all of this modulation in here, all of it, is just brushed away with a whiff of the hand, because in terms of the key planes, it's not important. Ditto here, all of this stuff going on between 89 and 107, 108 measures, 18 measures of stuff, I just brush it away. Now, in a higher level of reduction, what's called a foreground analysis, stuff would start reappearing in here, you know, where I start putting more in. At a more background level, a deeper background level, almost all of this would disappear. Just the C, the D, and the F would appear. So a reduction goes at all these various levels. You start out at almost the music the way the composer wrote it, and then you keep removing stuff. Everything that can be viewed as prolongations, extensions. If you ever get really interested in this stuff, and I hope I'm wetting your whistle, I'm teaching an entire year-long course in it next year, which the comp majors have to take, but is elective for everybody else. It's called Advanced Analysis, and we're actually going to learn Schenkerian analysis over the course of an entire year. Powerful tool. It's the first time it's been offered as a year-long course at the conservatory, and it's part of the core curriculum now, so I'm really proud of it. It's also a course that will serve double duty. It serves double duty as a history lit requirement and as a theory requirement. So because starting in the future, you have to take one of your theory electives has to be a history class, and one of them has to be in theory, and this particular course counts as both. So it's, I just want to recommend it. It's a brand new course starting next year, and it's going to be fun. And the composers, it replaces the old analysis requirement you had. It replaces that, but everybody's welcome to do it, and it'll be fun. Actually, it's a slow, very careful process. Fall semester, we'll learn technique. You know, it'll be a regular theory class with regular assignments where you're doing very short assignments, in a workbook and handing them in. And then in the spring, we start applying it to big pieces and start learning it. So it's going to be very interesting. I'm taking a middle ground between Orthodox Schenkerianism, which is a religion, and I won't go there with it, and really freewheeling, which I don't want to get that much either.
So I've kind of developed my own approach to it over the years, which is what everybody does. So anyway, this sort of stuff will seem a lot less mysterious. Let's go back and do it one more time, shall we? Give you a chance to go over this analysis. Then we go to the B flat here. Just a little prolongation of B flat, nothing more. Then to G. And then notice how long that A lasts. But it's just a dominant going to the D. That's that real cadence there. Then he starts a descending fifth sequence. I've marked that. See? And we do make it to F major again. You see? And immediately starts going out of it. But see, I've just reduced all that up. Until I get to C. Back, we're home. One other thing I should mention, by the way, about a reductive here like this is that classic reductive analysis is not on one stave but two. And there's a soprano, there's a treble clef that also applies a reduction to melodic and polyphonic lines as well. It's all of one. When you're doing an analysis that just shows harmonic motion alone, you can just use a bass clef like this. But when you're starting to use something that also includes melodic motion, which is a big part of this, you go on two staves. The whole goal of it eventually is that, according to Schenker's worldview anyway, that music would resolve itself to a series of archetypes, harmonic and melodic archetypes, of which the archetype of all, let's say in F major, is this. The ultimate archetype. 3-2-1 in the soprano, 1-5-1 in the bass. He called that the Ursatz. The upper line is called the Urlinie. It's called the Bassbrechtung. And the music would resolve itself to that, or a variant on it like that, or these variants. Now, that's a mystical view, and that I don't necessarily totally buy into. But it's a fascinating notion, isn't it? That there's an underlying archetype that governs musical form and structure, and that it's lying there. And what's amazing about it is how often it starts popping out of the analysis. You start working through it, and you start singing, and you start going, oh, my God, it's there. You know, and then other times, of course, you think, oh, it is not, you know. But the fact of the matter is that these archetypes of musical structure are very powerful. It's a very potent theory. It's a little hard to work with, but it's fun.